This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Emergency Contact by Mary H.K. Choi. Read by Joy Osmansky and Jacques Roy.
Penny. Tell me something, Penny. Penny knew that whatever Madison Chandler was going to say, she wasn't going to enjoy it. Madison Chandler leaned in close, mouth smiling, beady eyes narrowed. Penny held her breath. Why is your mom such a slut? The taller of the two girls glared pointedly at Penny's mom, who was chatting with Madison's father a few feet away. Blood pounded in Penny's ears. Possible reactions to Madison Chandler calling your mom a slut. 1. Punch her in the face. 2. Punch her disgusto, knuckle-dragging pervert father in the face. 3. Do nothing. Rage cry later in the privacy of your bedroom while listening to the Smiths. You are a dignified pacifist. Namaste. 4. Unleash the pyrokinetic abilities bequeathed to you upon birth, scorching the shopping mall with the fire of a trillion suns. Penny scanned her opponent's green-flecked blue eyes. Why was this happening? And at the Apple Store, no less? This was a safe space. A haven. Penny was almost out of this stifling town for good. She was so close. I asked you a question. Madison sucked her teeth. She had those clear braces that fooled no one. Punching her would be therapeutic. Hello, is anyone in there? So therapeutic. Christ, who was Penny kidding? It was option 3. It was always option 3. At this stage of the game, there was no need to be a hero, especially at 5-1 with a cute right hook and reaction times that were sluggish at best. Whatever. In 4 days, Penny would be off to college and the opinions of these micro-regionally famous people would no longer matter. Just as Madison drew back to glare at her from a different, arguably more menacing angle, Penny's assigned Apple genius materialized with her brand new phone. Deuce X Maxtor, dude. Penny clutched the smooth box. It gleamed with promise and felt expensively heavy in her hands. She glanced over by the laptops where Maddie's daddy, as he'd introduced himself, barf, was doing a looming, leering thing at her mom, Celeste. Penny sighed. She'd been campaigning for a new phone since Christmas, and this was not at all going down how she'd planned. Penny had envisioned more fanfare, at least some help picking out a case. Seriously, what's with your mom's geisha whore outfit? Okay, Madison Chandler may have gotten a Chanel caviar purse at 14, it was a hand-me-down, and a Jeep Wrangler at 16, but wow, there were sandwiches smarter than this girl. First off, geishas weren't prostitutes, common mistake, typically made by the willfully ignorant and intellectually incurious. Some geishas beguiled their clients with dance and artful conversation, like in Memoirs of a Geisha, a novel Penny adored until she discovered some rando white guy had written it. Second, as anyone with even the most cursory observational skills can tell you, the kimono offers exemplary coverage. It was burqa-adjacent, or perhaps cheddar-ish, since kimonos didn't have the hair and face covering, but... Still, Penny wished, not for the first time, that her mom would stop wearing crop tops, especially with leggings. It was positively gynecological. Penny, of course, was dressed in her customary shapeless black garb that was appropriate both day and night for being ignored by everyone. We're Korean, whispered Penny. Madison's lip twitched in confusion, as if she'd been informed that Africa wasn't a country. Geishas are Japanese, she finished. If you're going to be racist, you should try to be less ignorant, although maybe that was a contradiction. Mr. Chandler roared with laughter at something Celeste said, who, for the record, was hot, but not that funny. Danny, whined Madison, making her way toward him. Daddy? Yuck. Penny bet they were the type of family that mouth-kissed. Penny walked over, too.
If you want, you can come by my office and I can take a look at your portfolio, continued Mr. Chandler.
He was at least 6'5" and Penny could see straight up to his nose hair.
As I tell all my clients, it's the early bird who gets the retirement worm, especially with an empty nest.
He nodded at Penny.
Dang it, he said, patting his pockets with a practiced air. I don't have a card, but if you want to...
Mr. Chandler held his phone out and mimed typing into it with a toothy grin. Penny shut it down. Mom, Penny grabbed her by the wrist. We have to go. Everything about the way Penny's mom interacted with Mr. Chandler with his gleaming wedding ring and his hot pink polo shirt infuriated her. It was the same old tale with Celeste and Guys. You'd think she'd give it a rest and pay some attention to her only daughter the week before she left for college, but no, she was too busy flapping her lash extensions to some fake tanned creep. In the car, Celeste rearranged her boobs in her gray striped top and latched her seatbelt. Having a MILF for a mom was garbage. Celeste pulled out of the parking lot as the uneasy silence thickened. On the highway, the Japanese cat mounted on her mother's dashboard rattled. Penny stared at it. It was the size of a dinner roll, with a detached, spring-loaded head and blank cartoon eyes. This one, a recent addition, had usurped plastic Hello Kitty when Kitty's features got bleached off by the sun. Celeste insisted on accessorizing everything. It was pathological. It reminded Penny of the rich bitches in the Super Six, Maddie and Rachel Dumas and Allie Reed and the three other glossy-haired sadists who wore a ton of rings and bracelets and had a new sparkly phone case every week. You could hear them walking down the hall, since the jangling crap attached to their book bags made such a racket. Thing is, if Celeste had gone to Rainier High, she probably would have been friends with them. Penny longed for a crew. She was on "Oh Hey" status with a bunch of kids, but her closest school friend, Angie Salazar, transferred to Sojourner Truth High the summer before junior year, leaving Penny socially unmoored. If there were a sub-basement level with a trapdoor below utter invisibility, Penny would have found a way to fall into it. Her social standing was non-existent. The cat continued to rattle. If it carried on in this way, it would be toast before they hit the freeway. It was trinket Darwinism. A fragile animal had no business being mounted in a fast-moving vehicle. Certainly not a fast-moving vehicle commandeered by her mother, who had no right to commandeer anything in the whole wide... Why do you do that? Penny exploded. She wanted to punch a hole in the window and fling the cat out, possibly hurl herself after it. Today was meant to be different. Penny had let herself get excited about it for weeks. Her mom had taken the afternoon off, and it hurt Penny's feelings that Celeste would ditch her as soon as she saw the Chandlers. Not that Penny would admit what was really bothering her. Pathetic outcasts had standards, too.
What?
Celeste rolled her eyes. The teen-like gesture coming from her mom set her off even more. Penny wanted to shake Celeste until her fillings came loose. Why do you flirt with everyone all the time? Celeste was the mom equivalent of a feather boa, or human glitter. It's getting old, you know.
Who are you talking about?
Oh, you know exactly who.
Matt Chandler?
Yeah, gross, nasty Maddie's daddy, who incidentally is married.
I know he's married, Celeste huffed. Who was flirting? I was being polite, which, by the way, wouldn't kill you. With your eye rolling and scowls, do you know how embarrassing?
Embarrassing? Me?
Embarrassing you?
Penny balked. That's rich. Penny crossed her arms prissily. Mom, he was a creep, and you're there oozing your smiley ridiculous... The car cat clattered as if nodding.
How is he a creep? Because he wanted to give me investment advice?
Penny couldn't believe how dense her mother could be. It was clear to everyone that Matt wanted to give her a lot more than investment advice. Christ, even Madison knew what was up. How is it possible that you're this stupid? Celeste's mouth opened, then shut. A pained expression flashed across her face. Even the curls on her head appeared to deflate. Penny had never said anything as explicitly, deliberately mean to her mom before. She felt bad about it as soon as it flew out of her mouth, and while her mother wasn't dumb, she was frequently mistaken for being, well, a little airheaded. Celeste ran regional operations for a multinational events planning agency, spoke in hashtags, and was frequently dressed as if attending a boy band concert. That was her way. Penny was constantly running defense for her. The neighborhood men circled Celeste like sharks, conveniently underfoot to help with high supermarket shelves or offer unsolicited mansplainage on any number of topics. The way they lingered by Celeste's car, eyes glittering like seeds, as if waiting for something, sketched Penny out. It didn't help that Celeste was invariably welcoming. Just one example. Last Valentine's Day, Mr. Hemphill, their ancient mailman, presented Celeste with a tiny box of drugstore chocolates. It was the size of a mouse coffin, with four oxidized bonbons inside, and he kept mentioning the Vietnam War, as though they had something in common. It was clear that he wanted to wear their skin, and as far as Penny was concerned, this was the last guy you wanted knowing where you lived. Celeste wouldn't hear of it. Penny gazed out the window. Fighting with her mother had become routine, but now that Penny was leaving, Celeste had to get better at navigating the world. Steering clear of unrepentant scumbags was a start. Penny was exhausted, of worrying about Celeste, of resenting her. The flitting fast food restaurants and gas stations blurred in her vision. She blotted the hot stray tears with a sleeve so her mom wouldn't see. Later that day, Penny's boyfriend came by. Not that Penny ever publicly referred to Mark as her boyfriend. He functioned more as a stopgap for complete isolation when Angie moved away, which was a totally awful way to think about it, especially since empirically Mark was out of her league, at least physically. Which wasn't everything, except in high school maybe it was. Most of the time, Penny couldn't believe they were dating. When Mark first showed interest, Penny thought he was defective or else messing with her, and when he didn't seem to be doing that, her suspicion only grew. Penny was nothing if not aware of what she looked like, and what she looked like was exactly the same as she did when she was in first grade. Smallish eyes with a snub nose and humongous lips that her mother promised she'd grow into, but she never did. She and Mark looked confusing together. It didn't help that Penny had learned that relationships often seemed to mean the opposite of what you called them. You could have over 100 friends on social media and still have nobody to talk to. Just as Angie, that Brutus, had dubbed Penny her best friend until she ghosted completely. And while Mark referred to Penny as Bae, which just made her deeply uncomfortable because, gross, he also described pizza as not only Bae, but Bae AF, which... yeah, obviously, but that was the problem. They both liked pizza way more than their person. So, did you get it? Penny desperately wished she hadn't. Penny knew part of her lukewarm disposition toward Mark was that he was the type of guy Celeste would have picked out for her. He had dirty blonde hair and the preppy good looks of a Hollister model. Not on the billboard, but easily in a catalog group shot. Toward the front, since he was short. Mark was also younger by a year, which was clutch when you were sorta kinda not really but maybe dating, since that meant he had a different lunch period. His crew qualified as popular since it included moderately popular soccer kids, despite the rest of the squad being burnouts. Mark smoked a lot of weed and had a brain like a sieve, which was unfortunate. Even the cute things that would have made good inside jokes were forgotten, like how autocorrect on his phone kept changing "God damn it" to "God donut," So when Penny sent the donut emoji as an expletive, he only ever thought she was hungry. Mark was unwavering. Penny blinked first. Do you want a snack or something? She opened the fridge, grabbed a pitcher of sweet tea, and poured them both glasses. It was the only thing Celeste knew how to cook. Penny thought back to the first day Mark talked to her after fifth period. Thing was, he was defective, in a sense. Everybody knew he had yellow fever. His ex was this smoking hot Vietnamese girl, Audrey, whose dad was transferred to Germany with the Air Force, and in middle school he'd briefly dated Emily, who was half Thai.
Well?
Mark wouldn't be deterred.
Did you get it?
He grinned winsomely. Penny drew her tea to her mouth with such force that she hit the glass with her teeth.
Baby,
he said. Behind Bay, Penny despised baby as a thing for a grown adult woman to be called. It was so prescriptive, like dressing sexy for Halloween. Mark sat on a stool on the other side of the kitchen island and gestured alluringly for her to come over. His hair fell over his right eye. God, he was handsome. Mark opened his arms and she walked into them.
We may as well get used to communicating like this, Mark whispered, breath tickling her ear. We both hate talking on the phone, and you know what they say about pictures, Penny.
He paused for effect. Penny couldn't believe he was going to continue.
They're worth a thousand words.
Wow. Penny hitched her chin onto his shoulders. Mark smelled mildewy. It was comforting, in a sense. Mark often smelled as if he hadn't done laundry in a while. She weighed her options. Possible gambits to mount a distraction for a boyfriend who's prone to distraction. One, break up with him. A long-distance relationship based on cataclysmic levels of meh was soul-eating. Two, have sex with him to change the subject. Three, burst into tears and explain nothing. Yes, Penny sighed. I did get it. Then she added, thank you. She tried to sound sincere. Technically, it was a they, and they were nudes. Penny recalled the twin pepperoni constituting her boyfriend's nipples and inwardly shuddered. Mark thought sex were an appropriate and fun way to christen a new phone. Penny thought vehemently otherwise. Okay, so they weren't full-on frontal, bless. Mark was still 16, and Penny didn't need the FBI landing at her college dorm for kiddie porn. They were risque, though. Each went slightly beyond the treasure trail, with a few different filters. Penny was even sure he'd face-tuned at least one, which was a quality she simply could not respect in a man. She knew that the proper, more sporting response was to reciprocate. A boob, hint of nip-tops would suffice. But she didn't want to. At all. All she wanted to do was delete them, pretend none of this ever happened, and leave. She'd be off the hook then. At least technically. The statute for follow-up nudes couldn't extend beyond the city limits, surely. Even so, Penny should have considered going out of state.
Sam enjoyed an odd commute, a single staircase and about 9 yards of hallway. On one hand, he could rely on experiencing zero traffic. On the other, he felt like he was always at work. House Coffee, where Sam was manager, was an Austin institution. It was a small, gray craftsman with a gabled roof and a wraparound porch with a big white swing out front. It was, for lack of a better word, homey, and the first-floor cafe boasted creaky wood floors, large windows, built-in bookcases, and ratty sofas with mismatched chairs. The upstairs contained 4 rooms, 2 baths, and resembled the domicile of some wackadoo hoarder. When Sam first moved in, he'd snooped for hidden treasures that might fetch a fortune at auction. The actual findings were less Antiques Roadshow and more those TV specials where once the twin brothers die, both crushed under an avalanche of VHS tapes, They find $46 worth of stamps and thousands of empty Chef Boyardee cans where the changing labels denote the passage of time. Every room but one was overrun with boxes of files, books, clothes, and whatever else Al Petritus, the proprietor of house, couldn't fit in his own house. In the smallest room, farthest from the stairs, there was a mattress on the floor. That's where Sam slept. Like some orphan, which he technically wasn't, though he may as well have been. Sam lay in bed and collected his thoughts. It was dark out, still. Another restless night meant another grim day of functioning as if underwater. He glanced at his jailbroken iPhone. 4:43 a.m. He'd gone to sleep sometime before 2. He remembered a time when you couldn't kick him out of bed before noon. Salad days. Gah. At least there was coffee. Reliable, delicious, life-giving coffee. He padded downstairs. An hour later, the aroma of freshly ground beans commingled with the smell of carbs frying in grease. Christ, Sammy, donuts? Al Petritus, Sam's boss and landlord, loomed over him. At a head taller than Sam and 150 pounds heavier, Al was an enormous Greek with forearms the size of barrels. He reminded Sam a little of Donkey Kong, but Sam didn't think it was the sort of thing you told another man. Al was the first to sample any of Sam's baked creations, and the burly benefactor unfailingly called it trying. Even if he'd had a muffin 1,000 times, he'd say, Sammy, can I try a muffin? As if he didn't know exactly what the experience would be, as if there was any doubt that he would want the whole thing. Spoiler, Al always wanted the muffin. That was fine by Sam. Al didn't charge Sam rent, not a red cent, ever. His boss went so far as to pay Sam a few dollars over minimum wage. And for that, Sam would bake, cook, clean, and shave crop circles in the man's back if he'd ask. What is that, nuts? Al poked at a freshly glazed pastry with a meaty forefinger. Ever since he was a kid, Sam loved to cook and bake, whipping up increasingly complicated dishes, making substitutions wherever necessary, which was often since his mom rarely bought groceries and he was alone a lot. At 12, he discovered you could make a somewhat convincing facsimile of Thai food with peanut butter and jarred salsa, at least according to the palate of a preteen Texan of German descent who at the time hadn't tasted real Thai food. Al had given Sam free rein of the kitchen more than a year ago, ever since Sam had silently handed his boss a lemon chiffon cake for his wife's birthday, her favorite, with a post-it note on the top, for Mrs. Petritus. She'd declared it the best she'd ever tasted. And although Al knew better than to make a big deal of it, his better half insisted on passing Sam pamphlets for culinary school. For Sam's birthday, they bought him a small stack of hardcover cookbooks, and the gesture moved Sam so profoundly that he couldn't make eye contact with Al for a week. At the Petritus's urging, Sam secured his food handler's permit and now created a weekly menu of sandwiches, soups, and salads, as well as the pastries. He got up at 5 a.m. to prep, while Finley, his ace, his number two at house, a dark-skinned, lanky Mexican kid with a big hipster beard and a Scottish name, came in at 8 to man the register and bus tables. That one's pistachio, Sam told Al, and vanilla hibiscus, espresso, and salted dark chocolate. Sam had gotten the recipe from a food blogger, who said they were irresistible to women and wrote candidly about her exploits that testified to it. What? Sam handed over the tray as a matter of course. Yeah, I'll try a donut. Al's round face halved the smaller circle with a single bite. Amazing, Sammy, he said with his mouth full. Al's shadow hovered ever closer to sample the other flavors. Other than his mom, Al was the only person allowed to call him Sammy. Al cocked his head. Say, Sammy, you all right? Al was also the only one to regularly inquire about his mood. The thing about Sam was that he had a tell. Well, two. They weren't an exact science, but they gave you a sense. One was his hair. He had a great head of hair, dark and longer on top. His ex-girlfriend, who came up as liar on his phone now, had referred to it as irresponsible hair. If it was relaxed and tucked behind his ears, Sam was chill. If it was slicked back, he was spoiling for a fight. If it was fluffy, a very rare treat, it meant he completely trusted whoever was around at the time. Sam's hair hadn't been fluffy in a while. Today it was tucked back, yet also kinda done, with a telltale sheen of product. It was inscrutable. Avid Sam observers, especially if they were monitoring him in his own habitat, could check for his next tell. Sam's happiness was somehow tied to his desire to bake. When he walked into house, and there in the display case was a cold, lone scone and an anemic trio of store-bought Danish, you were better to keep a wide berth. You should treat him as you would a man with a scab where his eye had been and the words, "Not today, Satan," branded in giant letters across his forehead. With caution. While house bought their bread from Easy Tiger, pastries typically were Sam's domain. If the case and cake stands were resplendent with crunchy fresh-baked coffee cake, whoopie pies, or caramelized banana bread pudding pots with cream cheese frosting, it meant that Sam was liable to make out with you if you walked in. Plus, you'd enjoy it. Sam was a dynamite maker-outer. Today, he'd whipped together a dozen hand pies and the donuts and nothing else. And that could mean anything. Yeah, Al, doing great. Sam carefully face-planted the largest O into a shallow dish of vanilla hibiscus glaze and set it carefully on a wire rack. The smile may have been the most unnerving part. Sometimes Sam appeared a touch unhinged on the rare occasions he did it, as if his face were out of practice. Not that he frowned, either. That betrayed too much information. Mostly he just stared straight through you. "Okay, then," said Al, glancing over at Sam as he left, just to make sure. Sam dipped another donut in glaze. His hands were bony and veiny and moved quickly. His arms, lean, tanned, and blanketed in tattoos, would have looked at home on a Russian convict. Sam had a lot of tattoos, all over his chest, back, and calves. He wiped up a bright fuchsia dribble of icing with his left hand and continued dipping the remaining three donuts with his right. He was pleased with the results. Some guys wouldn't call baking or the ability to make a Pikachu foam cappuccino topper particularly manly pursuits, but Sam wasn't just any guy. He didn't concern himself with how fist-pumping frat dudes with crippling masculinity issues and no necks spent their time. Finn came in and immediately eyed the racks. There were six trays with four immaculate donuts cooling on each.
"What are these? Limited edition?" he asked. "We'll sell out these shits in an hour."
"Nah, they're off menu. I'm making these for someone," Sam said. Finn huffed the sweet donut steam.
"You can't bake for these girls out the gate, Sam. You gotta manage expectations."
Sam smiled his wonky smile. Finn studied him warily.
"Dude, please."
Finn's shoulders slumped.
"Come on, tell me these aren't..." "Please tell me you're not dating lying-ass liar again," said Finn, hands up in a defense pose. "Yo, I get it. She's hot, no disrespect. But the last time y'all broke up, I didn't know if I was going to make it."
Sam ignored any mention of the great love of his life.
"Seriously, Sam, you were in a bad place for so long," said Finn. "Monster-esque chemtrails coming out of your ears, man."
"They're not for her," Sam said. Finn hung up his backpack, threw on an apron, and glanced at the rack that held bloopers.
"Can I kill these?"
Sam nodded, and Finn took down a misshapen glazed in a single bite.
"Mmm," he said, cramming another half into his mouth. "These are way too good for her anyway."
Penny. It was the big day. Penny considered feeling sad. It was supposed to be bittersweet, wasn't it? Leaving home and going off to college was a thing. She blinked for moisture. No dice. Along the lines of having a sneeze you can't find or an itch that lives too deep under the skin, college felt surreal, conceptually out of reach. Even the application process felt like it was happening to someone else. It was unimaginable that there would be any consequences to filling out the forms and writing the essay. She applied to only one place, the University of Texas at Austin, and got in. By law, everyone in the top 10% of their Texas high school did. Penny's new phone chimed next to her on the bed. It was Mark.
"Good luck, baby. Text me when you get there."
Penny rolled onto her back and smiled. She considered what to write back. The screen beneath her thumbs was so shiny. God, her phone was beautiful. Rose gold in a black rubber case that read, whatever, whatever, whatever. It was easily nicer than anything she'd ever owned. She wiped down a smudge with her t-shirt. It was way too pretty to be desecrated with nudes, especially with a 2436 by 1125 pixel resolution at 458 ppi. Penny sent a generic smile emoji back. She went downstairs. While Penny's walls were bare, every other surface in Celeste's home, much like her car or her desk at work, was covered with keepsakes. According to Penny, her mom wasn't very mom-like, much less Asian mom-like. It wasn't solely that she dressed like a fashion blogger and was younger than other moms. Celeste didn't monitor Penny's homework or insist on piano lessons. Okay, so maybe Penny's idea of an Asian mom came from the movies, but she hadn't grown up with a lot of Asians in her life, let alone Koreans specifically. Penny had a Korean name and it was bogus. It was Penny. Not even Penelope, spelled out phonetically in Korean characters, so it didn't actually mean anything. When she was three, they'd visited her grandparents in Seoul, but she'd been too little to remember anything, and they'd never gone back. Celeste did, however, dedicate a Korean corner in her home. An altar, of sorts. It included a miniature Korean flag and a framed poster of the 1988 Olympics with a cartoon tiger mascot. There was also a small laminated picture of the pop star Rain in a white suit from years before he went into the military for mandatory service. The first time Penny's friend Angie came over, she asked her if it was a photo of her brother. Elsewhere in the house, there were snow globes galore, Eiffel Towers of varying sizes, and framed pictures of world-famous art, two renditions of Van Gogh's Starry Night, one on a tea towel, Monet's water lilies, and several of Degas' blurry ballerinas. Penny called the whole lot fridge magnet art. Stuff you'd seen enough times that you could imagine the factory workers in China rolling their eyes about having to keep churning it out. The only memento Penny prized was a framed picture of her parents. She'd carefully wrapped it in a t-shirt and stowed it in her backpack to bring to school. It was the only photo she had of them, possibly the only one in existence, and Penny treasured it. It was the source of 50% of the material in her dad dossier. Other information included: 1. Penny's mom and dad had met, of all places, in a bowling alley on dates with other people. 2. Her dad had a cute butt, Celeste's words, because he played baseball in high school. 3. They were inseparable. Until, of course, they weren't. 4. He was Korean, too. 5. His name was Daniel Lee, and as far as Penny knew, he lived in Oregon or Oklahoma. It could have been Ohio. In any case, it started with an O. 6. In those three states combined, there were 315 Daniel Lees. Some were probably white. Or perhaps black. In the picture, Penny's parents are at the beach at Port Aransas. They're kids. Celeste hasn't visibly changed over the years. Asian don't raisin, except her face was rounder then, fuller in the cheeks and lips. They're sitting on a black and yellow Batman beach towel. Daniel Lee has a straw cowboy hat perched on his head, but no shirt. Celeste's wearing a trucker hat that says, "Porn Star," a bright red bikini, legs crisscrossed, and she's grinning behind huge white sunglasses while holding an icy. Celeste swears the icy must have been a pregnancy craving since blue raspberry usually makes her gag. To Penny, it's cosmically unfair that her mom's tummy can be that flat while she's pregnant, but then it's hardly fair that her dark-eyed father would skip town 2 months before Penny was born, either. "He was the funniest guy I'd ever met," Celeste said when Penny unwrapped the parcel on her 8th birthday. "He asked the best questions." Penny had been asking a lot of questions for a genealogy assignment. She wanted to know everything, mostly as it related to her, whether he asked about Penny, if he had another family with brothers and sisters for her to play with, when she could see him. But Penny could tell Celeste hated talking about him. She became withdrawn and went to her room with a headache. So Penny shoved the questions to the back of her brain and never brought him up again. The photo she kept in her drawer. Downstairs, Celeste was sniffling in the kitchen, as she'd been when Penny went to bed. Penny suspected a performative aspect to her mom's crying, comparable to YouTubers sobbing during heavily edited confessional vlogs. Celeste bawled lustily during the semifinals of reality singing competitions and any movie involving animals. Penny would rather eat a pound of hair than reveal her true emotions, not to mention how Penny wasn't sure she'd be able to stop once she got going. Mom? Celeste glanced up from the wadded tissues in her hands. Her eyes were puffy, as if she actually had been crying all night. Hi, baby. She smiled before crumpling again. Can I please come with you? I could buy you lunch, help you decorate. I can buy my own lunch, Penny said. Plus, you'd have to trail me in your car and drive all the way back by yourself. I'd have to get back in my car and follow you to make sure you got home safe. A vicious cycle. Celeste swallowed. You know, I didn't know it would hurt this bad. She seemed genuinely surprised. Celeste's narrow shoulders quivered like an agitated chihuahua. Penny sighed and hugged her. She was going to miss her. No shit. Am I gonna cry? She squeezed her eyes tighter for any reciprocal condensation. Nope. Well, I'm proud of you, Celeste said, pulling away and smiling bravely. Penny peered down at her. Celeste seemed small. Feeble, really. And damp. In the afternoon light, in jeans and a faded t-shirt that read, Slay Hunty, Celeste resembled an incoming freshman as much as Penny did. It was sad that things had gotten so bad between them. When Penny was in grade school, they'd been thick as thieves. Back when the greatest excitement Penny could imagine was having a Starbucks salted caramel mocha for breakfast, Penny thought she was so lucky to have her mom as her best friend. She could stay up late, wear makeup, borrow her mom's clothes, and dye her hair any color of the rainbow. Life was a riot, a never-ending slumber party. In middle school, Penny started to see things differently. She no longer texted her mother 1,000 times a day for outfit approval or advice. Celeste and Penny became a study in contrast. Celeste was proud of her well-mannered, studious daughter, teaching her how to forge her name on letters from school and getting Penny her own credit card for fashion emergencies. Celeste encouraged Penny to get her hardship driver's license at 15, not because they needed her to, but because Celeste thought it would bolster Penny's popularity to drive her friends around. The harder Celeste tried, the more Penny pulled away. If anything, Penny resented that Celeste had decided somewhere along the way that her daughter could parent herself. Penny walked to the driveway with her mom trailing her. She turned for a one-armed hug, imagining herself as part of an animal control unit lassoing a python in a studio apartment. She held Celeste's gaze with her own the whole time. Then, with no sudden movements, she deftly popped the car door open with her free hand and slid in. Seatbelt fastened, Penny eased out of the driveway and into freedom. Part of her dreaded going to college alone. In the Instagram stories version, her dad would haul her boxed-up belongings in a big truck. They'd argue about what to play on the way there, and he'd give up the aux cord since he'd miss her so much. As he left, he'd get choked up, handing her $50 while mumbling something about making good time, and Penny would know deep in her heart how much he loved her. "I love you, baby!" wailed Celeste, jolting Penny from her thoughts. Penny rolled down her window. "I love you too, Mommy. I'll call you later, I promise." This time, Penny did feel a pang. Her nose got that stinging, chlorine feeling you get right when you're about to cry. She checked her rear view to see her already small mom getting smaller, waving big. An hour and a half later, Penny pulled into the curved driveway at Kincaid. "Jesus," she whispered, clutching her steering wheel to gaze up at the building. Kincaid was among the oldest dorms at UT, and it was hideous. Penny wondered if you could feel the ugliness from the inside. Boasting 8 floors painted in alternating blue and salmon layers, it resembled a Miami hotel from the 1970s more than a dorm. 80 units of eyesore that were the tackiest part of the campus skyline. The lurid hues reminded Penny of kicky animal print scrubs favored by pediatric oncologists. It was the upbeatness that made the whole thing depressing. Throngs of anxious parents and freshmen huddled around SUVs carting enormous plastic bins, laundry baskets, and floor lamps. Just as Penny rolled down her window to scope the scene, a freckly brunette stuck her face into her car until they were nose to nose. Her eyes were bulbous, glinting with a helpfulness that bordered on menacing.
"Name?"
yawped the girl. Penny smelled Fritos on her breath.
"Lee,"
she supplied. "Penelope."
"Lee?"
She drew her finger down her clipboard and then tapped it.
"Ah," she said triumphantly. "There you are, sweetie."
Ugh. Sweetie. This chick was 19 tops. The girl's eyes flickered over Penny's red lipstick. Penny had found it with a note to smile more in her backpack pocket. Celeste had a habit of tucking cosmetics or clipped out articles about the effects of positive thinking among Penny's things. Sneak attack gifts that felt like criticism.
"Sweetie," Penny sang back, "can you back up a smidge? You're practically inside my face with your face."
She said it exactly how she imagined the girl would, with everything going up in a question. There was no way Little Miss Texas Cornchip was going to sweetie her into submission. The girl swiftly withdrew her head.
"Oh my God," she chirped, bleached teeth gleaming. "So many of the parents literally can't hear me. I've been yelling for hours."
The girl inspected Penny's lipstick again.
"Wait, I'm obsessed with how matte that is. What is it?"
"Isn't it fabulous?" Penny enthused, reaching for the tube in her bag.
"Too thought to trot?"
She read off the sticker on the bottom. Christ, she felt as if saying makeup names out loud set women's rights back several decades.
"Ugh, I knew it. I love Stax lip kits. You know, TTTTs sold out everywhere, right? Why are the good reds always quick strike?"
"Ugh, right?" exclaimed Penny, who had no idea what she was talking about.
"It's the worst."
The girl rolled her eyes theatrically in agreement.
"Okay, so you're in 4F,
she said, drumming her shellac nails on her clipboard.
"Elevators are toward the back, and you can unload anywhere you see a blue sign, but..."
She placed a purple laminated pass on her dash.
"This buys you parking for the rest of the day. Just return it to the front desk when you're done."
"Thank you," said Penny brightly.
"You're a lifesaver."
The girl beamed.
"I know."
Penny's face strained from the false cheer. It was frankly impressive that Celeste's addiction to trendy makeup and some doofus imprinting on her like a baby farm animal could land her parking privileges. More yakking and some thigh-slapping laughter at dad jokes scored Penny a hand truck from her neighbor down the hall. Rules for friendliness were a racket. In no time, college Penny would be as adored as Celeste. Granted, she'd have to get a lobotomy to keep it up, but maybe the exchange rate was worth it. When Penny swung her door open, she noticed the following. Her room smelled of Febreze with a top note of musty carpet. It was discouragingly small to be shared with another person. Plus, it was already inhabited by a dark-haired girl sitting on the bed by the window. A girl who was not her roommate. Penny and Jude Lang had Skyped twice over the summer, and this chick with indoor sunglasses and a wide-brim Coachella hat was not her. The girl neglected to glance up from her phone. "Hello?"
Penny began lugging her stuff in. The girl silently continued typing. Penny cleared her throat. Finally, the girl removed her oversized, bedazzled sunglasses to get a glimpse of Penny. She had famous people eyebrows and wore a tan suede vest with foot-long tassels.
"Where's Jude?" the girl asked in a manner that suggested Penny worked there.
I don't know.
The girl rolled her eyes and returned to her phone. Penny glared and once again wished her hostility could incinerate people. Possible responses to a possible home invader who was possibly a maniac and possibly has a switchblade under her hat. 1. Fight her. 2. Start screaming and pull your own hair to signal that you're even crazier and not to be trifled with. 3. Introduce yourself and find out more information. 4. Ignore her. Unsurprisingly, Penny chose the path of least resistance. She grabbed her toiletry bag out of her suitcase and made a beeline for the bathroom. It was the size of a closet. You could have washed your hair while sitting on the toilet by leaning into the shower stall. Penny placed her bag on the toilet tank, figured it was perilously close to potential pee splashback, and set it on the side of the sink. From another stash bag, she pulled out a roll of toilet paper, a microbe-free shower curtain, a toothbrush holder that didn't have a well on the bottom where water could collect, a brand new shower mat, and towels. Penny arranged everything exactly the way that made sense. TP was hung in the correct direction, over, obviously. Under was for murderers. When she was done, she marched back out and went for option 3. "Penelope Lee, Penny," she said, extending her hand to the girl. The girl stood up and considered Penny's paw with distaste until Penny was forced to lower it. Penny's eyeline was to her boob. Option 1 would not have been cute.
"Mallory Sloan Kidder," she said, still typing on her phone. "Though I'm in the process of changing my name to Mallory Sloan, professionally."
Mallory had symmetrically winged eyeliner, thick hips, and pointy metallic nails. Penny didn't know what "professionally" implied. "Actor," Mallory Sloan, formerly Kidder, said briskly. She sat back down and crossed her legs. Her nails tap-danced furiously as she texted.
"I've done off-off-off-Broadway."
Penny wondered about the jurisdiction of off-off-off-Broadway. It probably had nothing to do with actual Broadway in New York. With enough imagination, hyphens, and prepositions, the corner of East Cesar Chavez and Chican could probably qualify as off-Broadway.
Rad?
Penny said. Mallory held up a finger to indicate for her to wait.
"It's Jude," she said, typing into her phone. "Your roommate."
"Cool.
She's my best friend, you know."
Tappity, tappity, tap.
"Since we were 6.
Penny rolled her eyes, quickly so she wouldn't get her ass beat by this giant.
"Is everything okay?"
Mallory held up her finger again. Penny wondered how much force it would require to break it in 3 places.
"She wants us to meet her at a coffee shop on the drag."
There had to be some rule against moving to a second location with a stranger. For all Penny knew, her new roommate and this obnoxious broad could be best friends from a fetish message board that specialized in cutting up Asian girls for hot dogs. It was also typical. Penny was at college 10 minutes and she was already the third wheel.
"Let's go."
Mallory set about collecting her things and then looked at a dawdling Penny as if she were stupid.
"Look, they have donuts."
Penny grabbed her backpack. Mallory Sloan Kidder might have been an asshole, but her argument was airtight.
Sam. Jude smiled at Sam. Sam smiled at Jude. Jude's smile was better than Sam's. Sam remembered the first time she'd smiled at him. It was Christmas Day a decade ago, and Sam was ornery when he opened the door. Bad enough he was forced to wear itchy pants that bunched at the crotch, but to add insult to injury, his mom, Brandy Rose, made him put on a tie. Put on a tie, she'd said, just like that. She had curlers in her hair and smelled of the perfume that had appeared mysteriously in a glass teardrop on the bathroom counter. "Hurry up," she swatted his arm as she squeezed past in their comically snug hall. Sam studied her as she shambled into the kitchen and tried to see her as a man would, as a woman. She looked haggard. The broken blood vessels around her nose had been covered with a thick powder that aged her. "What tie?" he shot back. At no point in his 11 years of existence had anyone thought to buy him a tie. She huffily pulled one from his dad's stuff that was collected in Walgreens bags in the hall closet and threw it at him. It was green and maroon with musical notes at the bottom. "Do you even know how to tie a tie?" she shouted, switching on the vacuum. "Obviously," he yelled back. He YouTubed it. It used to be that Sam's mother spent her days off from the hotel in her room, dead to the world. But these past few weeks had been ominously different. She'd spent days baking, cleaning, and buying holiday decorations they couldn't afford. Her nervous energy made Sam watchful, though it had been oddly reassuring to see the kolaches arranged on cookie sheets, prune and apricot. There were also spiced stars, Zimtstern in German, that made the air fragrant with cinnamon, reminding Sam of happier times, like the one Christmas they'd spent as a family with a shitty plastic tree and a few of his dad's vinyl records wrapped in newspaper for Sam underneath. They hadn't celebrated the holiday for years, and he could tell from Brandy Rose's short temper and the tremble in her hands that she was at least sober for once. Sam loosened his tie as he answered the door. Brandy Rose wasn't big on communication, and other than the barb about the tie and instructions to look nice, Sam didn't know what she had planned. He hadn't been expecting company, and certainly not a kid, let alone a smiling, blonde, 7-year-old girl in a blue velvet dress and a ponytail. The kid had the same hoarse face as the stern, brown-haired guy next to her. His eyes were dark, as cold as holes, and behind them was Brandy Rose's new boyfriend, Mr. Lang. He held a red satin bag aloft with a bottle of champagne peeking out of the top. His smile faltered only for a second when he saw that it was Sam.
"Merry Christmas, kiddo," bellowed Mr. Lang.
"Hey," said Sam. Mr. Lang was 69 years young. It's how he'd described himself to Sam when they'd first met, grinning and waggling his eyebrows at the mention of 69. He was Brandy Rose's fiancé as of a month ago. Sam had met him exactly once during their alarmingly short courtship. They'd gone out for steak dinners at Texas Land and Cattle, and the crypt keeper kept touching his mom's knee. Sam wondered if his hand felt like twigs and dry leaves, especially since Mr. Lang had wiry white hair on his knuckles.
"She's a spitfire, this one," he told Sam,
stroking his mother again on the thigh. They'd met at the front desk of the Marriott, where Brandy Rose worked, and Mr. Lang often stayed.
"Old-fashioned, too. Wouldn't give me the time of day until she saw I was serious."
He'd lifted her hand for Sam to see. A teardrop-shaped emerald sparkled on her ring finger, her birthstone. Brandy Rose giggled, a foreign, hollow sound that horrified Sam.
"This is Drew, my son," Mr. Lang said, patting the other man on the shoulder. "And my granddaughter, Jude."
Sam nodded evenly.
"Oh,"
sputtered Brandy Rose, appearing behind him. Her voice was strangled, higher pitched than usual.
"You said you were picking us up."
She evidently hadn't expected company either.
"You're not Sam,"
interrupted the kid. Apparently, he and his mother were in the presence of 3 generations of geniuses. The men wore suits. Sam pulled on his tie again.
"It's my fault," said Drew, shooting his hand out to Brandy Rose by way of a greeting. "I insisted."
She took it, and Sam instinctively stepped toward Drew to buffer his mom.
"We were having Christmas lunch at the Driscoll," Drew explained, casually pointing out that Sam and his mother hadn't been invited to the fancy hotel restaurant. "And as you can imagine, the notion of a complete stranger marrying my father just didn't sit right with me. I had to see what his new lady was about."
He said this in an affable manner that belied its implication, that he suspected Brandy Rose was a gold digger.
"Oh,"
said Brandy Rose again. Sam fought the urge to slam the door.
You're way too little to be my uncle, whispered Jude.
It was trippy how memories worked. Sam couldn't dredge up a solitary detail from Thanksgiving Day 2 years ago, or what he'd done this past New Year's, yet he remembered everything about when he and Jude met. The little kid wouldn't shut up. Mr. Lang and Brandy Rose made short work of the champagne, and Drew parked Jude in Sam's room with a plate of cookies while the grown-ups talked. Jude's family was loaded. At 7, she had her own iPad and phone, as well as a bag of travel-size games, and as much as Sam wanted to ignore her, she wouldn't stop yammering.
Do you know how to play backgammon?
She set up the pieces on his bed. Sam cranked up the music in his shitty headphones and turned his back in response, until the yelling really got going. That's the thing about mobile homes. The walls were wafer thin. Jude's eyes widened. Sam sighed, plugged his headphones into Jude's iPad, and put them on her. He showed her a few videos, heavy hitters like corgis wobbling on a trampoline and baby pandas squirming to a medley of dancehall music. There was a supercut of a cockatoo that played piano with its feet, and once Jude settled into an instructional of a woman making cupcakes resembling acid-washed jeans, Sam checked on his mom. Through the crack of his door, he could see Brandy Rose at the sink alone, drinking a tall glass of orange juice that likely contained as much vodka. The men were out of sight, though not out of earshot. For the next hour, Sam and Jude watched videos. By the end of the afternoon, Sam could tell a kind of resolution had gone down. He hoped the wedding was called off, that Mr. Lang's impetuous proposal had been the handiwork of a senile man, and his jerk son had in fact saved the day. They weren't quite so lucky. The happy couple married a few weeks later with a 5-day honeymoon cruise on the Mayan Riviera. Despite the joyous nuptials and the infinite promises, Brandy Rose's husband failed to move them out of their trailer home. Nor did he ever spend a night in her bed. When it came time for the Langs to leave, Jude's dad collected her, took out his wallet, removed 4 $20 bills, and tossed them on Sam's bed, not once looking directly at him. He shut the door without a word.
"Uncle Sam," trilled Jude.
5 years of extensive orthodontia and a contraption known as a reverse-pull headgear had corrected the more equine aspects of Jude's face. "Hey, Jude," he said. It was unsettling to see her again. They'd had coffee a month ago when she was in town for orientation, yet at no point in the following weeks did Sam believe she'd leave California to study 6 blocks away. Jude was now 5'10 to Sam's 6 foot. Okay, 5'11 and a half. But whereas Sam was scrawny, Jude was solid. She reeked of health in that sun-kissed West Coast way. Sam bet she could bench-press him if she wanted. He felt both strangely protective of her in a mammalian way, like how he imagined people in normal families felt toward each other, and deeply uncomfortable that she'd be hanging around.
"Yay!"
Jude squealed, engulfing him.
"It's Uncle Sam!"
She'd taken to calling him that on the flurry of texts signaling her arrival. She thought it was hysterical since Sam wasn't exactly the USA, USA type. Nor was he her uncle anymore. Brandy Rose and Mr. Lang's doomed union lasted just under 2 years. A month before he'd owe alimony, he proposed to a 25-year-old server from a Cracker Barrel in Buda. He was a class act through and through. The pressure of Jude's tanned arms encircling him was pleasant, a relief. It had been several months since Sam had been embraced with uncomplicated affection, and his ex-niece was like a giant golden retriever that loved you on sight. "You hungry?" he asked, squirming out of the hug. "How was the flight? Are your folks here? How's it feel to be a freshman?" Then a beat. "Do you love questions?" Sam awkwardly fixed his hair and took a slug of coffee to have something to do with his hands.
"Caffeine's a hell of a drug," she said, eyeing his cup.
He laughed. "To your first question, I'm starving," said Jude. "Flight was good. Parents couldn't agree on who should bring me down, so we settled on nobody. They're splitting up." "I'm sorry." Sam had met Jude's mother only once. She was tanned and wore yoga clothes to dinner, and Sam had never warmed to her dad.
"It's fine," she said, and gave him a crooked smile. "They were miserable, By the way, they say hi.
No, they don't, Sam said. Jude laughed.
Well, my mom does, she admitted. But my dad did ask about you, whether or not you had plans to go back to school.
Sam shrugged. We'll see, he said.